Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
And you can see how precarious they are. If one goes, they're all going.
The risk of a major rock slide is causing cruise ships to skip Skagway. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, biologists plan to study how kelp farms could boost the economy and impact fish.
Some may be helped by the presence of the farms. It might create habitat, it might create food sources. Some might be deterred from the presence of these farms.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Civil rights groups are suing Alaska state elections officials over the state's decision to discard more than 7,000 mail-in ballots during last summer's mail-in primary for U.S. House. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Native American Rights Fund, the League of Women Voters, and the Arctic Council argue that the Division of Elections violated Alaska's constitution by failing to give voters a chance to correct the issues. More than 4.5% of ballots cast in the special primary were discarded. Most went uncounted because of problems with information on the envelope, incorrect identifiers, or a lack of a witness signature. That's something the lawsuit alleges would not have happened if the division had done a better job letting voters know what to expect. They also argue the division had time to let voters fix their ballots before the results were counted. The ballot rejection rate from the election was also higher in communities with more Alaska Native residents. In House District 38, which includes Bethel and the lower Kuskokwim area, that rate was as high as 16%, according to the complaint. About 83% of voters in that region are Alaska Native. The civil rights organizations are asking the Alaska Superior Court in Anchorage to notify voters when their ballots have issues that would leave them uncounted and give the voters a chance to fix problems. It's a process known as ballot curing. In a statement, State Department of Law spokesperson Patty Sullivan says state attorneys are reviewing the suit and will respond in court. A member of the military has been charged with manslaughter in a fiery crash in Anchorage that killed 2 people on Sunday. According to charging documents, 23-year-old Matthew Davis told authorities he was so drunk he didn't remember driving. Anchorage police today identified the two who died as 20-year-old Derek Dewar and 18-year-old Amelia Nowak. Davis also faces charges of driving under the influence in the incident that police say involved him hitting 3 vehicles in and near downtown Anchorage. His bail was set at $80,000. Davis told police he consumed between 10 and 15 drinks at several downtown bars before the crash, and the charges say his blood alcohol content later measured 3 times the legal limit. Well, Skagway closed half of its busiest cruise ship dock for the rest of the season after a series of rock slides smashed holes through it and damaged infrastructure. Now, people are safer, but those rocks are crushing the town's tourism economy. KTOO's Claire Strempel reports.
Skagway Mayor Andrew Cremata pushes through some hemlocks on the ridge above town to get a better look at loose boulders hanging over the White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad dock.
See how it's all just falling apart? Crumbling? Look at all this loose rock here.
Usually, 500,000 cruise ship tourists meet their tour guides or board buses and trains here. But city-hired geologists released a report this summer with a sobering message. There could be a catastrophic slide here with little to no warning.
And you can see how precarious they are. If one goes, they're all going. And this is the good side.
The view up here above the slide path is stunning. In one direction, a glacier-carved fjord reflects a jagged crown of mountains. In the other, the town's brightly painted Gold Rush-era buildings. The port is studded with three huge cruise ships.
There goes some rock. And then look what's right at the bottom of the slide.
Everything looks tiny below. People are just specks on the dock.
The side of this mountain will come down. It's a matter of when.
Fermata gestures at the town's fuel tanks and the helicopter pad and says he's worried that if enough rock came off the mountain, a massive slide could take out everything on the waterfront. There have been four serious rock slides on the dock since June. Boulders punched a hole right through the concrete and rebar so you can see the water below. Others damaged a cruise ship there. Residents say cruisers and local children selling newspapers were in the impact zone just minutes before the rock came down. Now, some ships are skipping Skagway and taking their business to Sitka or Ahuna. And instead of four ships, the city can accommodate only three at a time. That's a loss of about 100,000 passengers for the rest of the season. And, of course, all the money they would have spent.
Are you guys looking for the Klondike Tours bus?
Billy Joe Clem is trying to flag down cruise ship passengers to get them to take one of her buses. They used to wait right at the dock for passengers to get off the ships, but since it closed, cruise ships are sending people to shore on small boats.
Which is financially devastating for us.
She says tourists are struggling to find her buses as they get rerouted around the slide area. It's cut her business in half, and she's had to lay off some of her drivers.
If we don't have the tours and we don't have the people from the ships, we just can't afford to keep them, and we've cut everybody else's hours down.
At the railroad station, throngs of tourists are waiting to board one of the trains that run hourly up the winding rail to the White Pass summit. It's Skagway's biggest draw. The White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad has been the town's largest employer for nearly 125 years. Tyler Rose, the company's executive director of human resources and strategic planning, says the city's report overstates the imminent risk of a rock slide.
Well, it's always been a concern. And I know for us, it's not a heightened concern because we've always taken it very seriously.
He says White Pass identified a slide risk decades ago. They've been monitoring the area since 2017 when an earthquake let loose two rock slides. The company repurposed shipping containers as a protective tunnel for cruise ship passengers to walk through and put up barriers to catch falling rocks. That appeared to solve the problem until the rock slide this June. Geologists for the railroad said in a memo that their research has been more extensive than the city consultants' review. They say there's no increased risk of rock slide compared to previous years they've monitored. It also said their instruments on the mountain would forewarn the railroad of any movement indicating a rock slide was imminent. Rose had hoped to reopen the dock this season, but it's clear now, after several more rock slides came down without warning, that that's not going to happen.
You know, we want to work closely with the municipality to both solve this problem and seek funding wherever we can, because it will be a financially challenging proposition for both of us.
The city and the railroad are working together to try and reduce risk at the slide zone. They have a plan, but it's a massive undertaking and likely to cost tens of millions of dollars. Mayor Andrew Cremata is serious about making it happen, and quickly.
But come next April, we need to be able to put four ships here and make sure that our business owners have the best chance they can have at making as much money as possible as the cruise industry rebounds.
The plan is to fly heavy machinery to the top of the mountain by helicopter and start taking pieces of it down. The goal is to decrease the steepness of the mountainside so rocks don't tumble off. A team of design contractors is in Skagway this week to see how and if it can be done. Reporting in Skagway, I'm Claire Strempel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two rescued harbor seal pups get ready to go back to the ocean.
To be able to, you know, release them into the ocean and see them swim away and just know that there's this amazing life ahead of them, like, that's so amazing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Earlier this month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released its first ever strategic plan for mariculture in the state of Alaska. As KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth reports, it's an attempt to get the science up to speed with a burgeoning industry.
NOAA's Aquaculture Strategic Science Plan encompasses 5 years' worth of goals and priorities for Alaskan kelp and oyster farms and other niche forms of mariculture, like the cultivation of sea cucumbers and abalone. It identifies areas where it expects the industry to grow and where the agency needs to expand its own research. It also identifies partnership opportunities with other organizations. Jordan Hollersmith is the mariculture and macroalgae lead research biologist for the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. She helped author the report. She says it's kind of like a research blueprint for the road ahead.
This document was sort of our guiding document of how do we see NOAA's role in mariculture research in Alaska.
That could be a major question for the state in the years to come. Governor Mike Dunleavy has said he wants to make Alaska the mariculture capital of the world, and he put together a mariculture task force to develop a 5-year plan detailing how to turn Alaskan aquaculture into a $100 million industry. According to NOAA, less than 100 kelp farms are currently in operation in the state, mostly in southeast Alaska and in the waters off Kodiak Island. Those farms are valued at less than $2 million. Other areas of the country, like parts of coastal New England, have also experienced a mariculture boom. But there isn't a lot of research on kelp farming that's specific to Alaska. Hollersmith says one area that NOAA is interested in as the industry continues to grow is how kelp farms might affect fish habitat.
We really want to know, how do those species respond to these farms? Some may be helped by the presence of the farms. It might create habitat. It might create food sources. Some might be deterred from the presence of these farms.
Similarly, as mariculture expands in Alaska and ocean conditions change, Hollersmith says future NOAA research could help create a kind of bumper crop for coastal communities.
We can pick where we're growing, where we're setting these farms, and try and target areas where it seems like they might be experiencing more stable conditions. We can also target the species that are farmed.
Hollersmith says there's a lot to learn, but the fact that NOAA is asking those questions indicates an enthusiasm for mariculture and exciting future for the industry in Alaska. NOAA's Aquaculture Strategic Science Plan is published on the agency's website. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
The Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development was in Alaska recently, and while she was here, Adrienne Todman announced more than $220 million in funding for affordable housing and development to benefit Alaska Native and American Indian communities, as well as more than $800,000 to help house Native American military veterans at risk of or experiencing homelessness. But Todman wasn't just here to talk money. Her trip was filled with meetings and tours in Anchorage, Wasilla, and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, including Napakiak and Oscarville, to learn about Alaska's housing challenges and to see the work the department has been funding already.
So the Indian Housing Block Grant provides funds to the tribal councils in Alaska to build housing and to preserve the housing that they have. And I'm very proud to say that that formula, which had been flat funded for so many years, that under the Biden administration, we were able to bump it up by 22%. And so the good folks in Alaska were able to receive $115 million just this year alone. In addition, we have a fair amount of staff that are dedicated to tribal leaders and housing entities in the state of Alaska. I believe the HUD office there has the largest, if not one of the largest, complements of staff dedicated solely to tribal housing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned some of the challenges that folks told you about off the road system. Tell me more about that. What did they tell you? Was it different from one community to the next?
Certainly. You know, not too long ago, I myself built housing, and I was just amazed by some of the challenges that communities in Bethel, particularly those who are off the road system, really have to deal with. I mean, the concept of only having materials arrive by barge twice a year, which is an example of one of the challenges that was shared with me, is astonishing. The fact that there's a shortened construction season also presents its own challenges. And through all of this, it means that, you know, the time delays and the way that materials get there only contributes to the additional costs of building housing in Alaska. And so it was truly a learning experience for me, and certainly one that the other HUD members who had went with me on the trip were all sort of wrapping our brain around and trying to find ways to be a resource for the families and for the individuals who were there.
Gotcha. Yeah. When you were traveling out off the road system in some of those communities, we've heard that there is crowding, that you have, you know, multi-generational families living in the same house, and that it's just generally crowded in some places. Did you get a chance to see that, and could you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, I was able to witness some of the overcrowding experience that's happening. I had the opportunity to walk through both of the villages that I visited, and you know, it's just a reminder of how much more work we have to do. You know, overcrowding is usually symbolic with the lack of housing affordability. And I certainly witnessed that during my trip there. And like I said, it only inspired me and the team to just be ever more laser focused on ways that we can build more capacity where it's needed with the housing leaders in Alaska to fight for more resources for Indian country, not just in Alaska, but across the country, and really do everything we can to lift up some of the best practices that we're seeing happening in Alaska. And so we can sort of cross-pollinate some of those ideas and be a resource, but also bring ideas perhaps from the lower 48 to our housing leaders in Alaska. You know, sad to say, housing affordability and housing supply is not unique to Alaska. And there's lots of really creative things that are being done. You know, the president just a couple of months ago released a housing supply action plan that actually has in mind some of the things that I saw and witnessed when I was there in Alaska. We've seen this. We have a plan to try to make improvements, and we're going to continue to fight for resources for the families in Alaska.
That was Housing and Urban Development Deputy Secretary Adrienne Todman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein online at lbblawyers.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
A ferry bound for Prince of Wales Island had to turn around Tuesday afternoon after a taxi driver accidentally stowed away. Inter-Island Ferry Authority General Manager Ron Curtis said the ferry Stikine had to return to Ketchikan when the cabbie failed to disembark after helping his passenger load a 70-inch TV onto the ferry. The vessel made a U-turn in the Tongass Narrows about 10 minutes after it departed, and after discharging the extra passenger, the Stikine departed again for Hollis at about 3:45 p.m. A group of international researchers is out in the Bering Sea this summer exploring the deepest parts of the ocean. KUCB's Laurelyn Cruz has the story.
There are 38 scientists from 12 different countries aboard the research vessel SAN. Each one has their own area of expertise and their own questions. One biologist specializes in sea sponges. Another studies isopods, a type of crustacean that can be smaller than a fingernail and carries its young in a pouch like a kangaroo. Others on board operate underwater cameras or use sound to make maps of the seabed. Together, they want to learn what's living on the seafloor, miles below the ocean surface.
We would like to understand the animals who live in this remote environment under these extreme conditions of high pressure, no light, very little food supply.
That's Dr. Angelika Brandt, calling in from onboard the ship. She's from Germany and is the chief scientist on the Aleutbio expedition. The team set off from Unalaska in July to explore deep sea biodiversity. And they'll stay out on the water through early September, taking samples in the eastern Bering Sea and the Aleutian Trench. Brandt says up to 80% of all species on Earth live in the ocean, and the deeper we go, the less we know about the inhabitants.
It is not easy to identify species from an area that is completely unknown. There are no books. There is no determination literature. Because it is unknown.
This is the first time scientists are taking such a close look at what lives in those depths near the Aleutians. To gather samples more than 4 miles down, they drop trawl nets from the deck of the ship. These giant nets scoop up whatever's sitting on the ocean floor. To get even deeper than that, they use a machine called a multicorer. It punches out cores of sediment to see what's living in the seabed. They also send down a camera to look at the larger animals. The species they find can vary a lot between sample sites. The team has been pulling up sponges and brittle stars, carnivorous worms, and tiny crustaceans. Many of the creatures are too small to see with the naked eye. Brandt says it takes teamwork to identify so many distinct species, and to use the specialized technology needed to do the job.
Everybody has a special niche. And so everybody works on one piece of the puzzle, and we can put that together in the end to get a more comprehensive view of the biodiversity.
Once the researchers get a complete picture of what they found, they want to compare it to what lives in the nearby waters of the Arctic Ocean and Kuril-Kamchatka Trench in the Northwest Pacific Ocean. Brandt says these are areas likely to have similar environmental conditions, and species might move from one place to another. Why is that so important? According to Brandt, animals are already changing where they live in response to climate change, and researchers need a way to track these rapid shifts. And, she says, understanding life on our planet is the first step to protecting it.
Without knowing species, you cannot conserve them. So for species conservation, we need to know what lives there.
The Aleutbio expedition will end in Vancouver on September 6th. In Unalaska, I'm Laurelyn Cruz.
Two harbor seal pups who were rescued in Kisilov earlier this summer are ready to be released back to the ocean. The 2.5-month-olds have spent the summer living at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. They've gained weight and new skills, which feels familiar. And now, as the Sea Life Center puts it, they've graduated from fish school. KBBI's Hope McKinney reports.
So if you want to go out and see their habitat?
That would be amazing.
Okay.
It's a rainy day in Seward as we're walking outside the quarantine facility at the Sea Life Center to what's referred to as the Big Kid Pool, where the two harbor seal pups, Admiral and Cobalt, are hauled out in their enclosure, dead fish floating beside them in the pool. The silvery-spotted seal pups are 2.5 months old, and they've called the center home for almost their entire lives. But now, after months of training and care, they're ready to go back into Cook Inlet. And it's in large part because of people like this.
My name is Savannah Costner.
Costner is part of a team that's been working with the pups since early June. The seals came to the center as newborns after their mothers abandoned them on a Kisilov beach. Part of her role is making sure Cobalt and Admiral are prepared to be released back into the wild and don't spend the rest of their lives in captivity. She says that usually involves as little human interaction as possible, so the pups don't bond to her or any of the other technicians. They try to keep the pups fully self-sufficient and uninterested in them.
We keep all of our talking to a minimum. We never talk to them. Even though we have all of this love and feeling for them, we never tell them.
The technicians instead use hand signals to communicate when in the room with the pups or step away to discuss things. They also use a technique they call observance without disturbance, where they're ready to step in if something goes wrong, but where they can't be seen by the small pinnipeds all the time. Still, there is some hands-on time. Costner cleans Cobalt and Admiral every day, and she gives them their meds, helps out with swim time, and feeds them.
So we feed our kiddos. We try to replicate what mom would be doing out in the ocean. So we feed them at 8, noon, 4, 8, and 11.
The seals start out on a harbor seal formula, mimicking their mother's milk. Then at about 4 to 6 weeks, animal care specialists start introducing blended fish into the formula, essentially creating a fish milkshake. That's a kind of precursor to getting them to actually eat pieces of fish or full fish on their own. That part can sometimes be tricky and can involve tube feeding. But Costner says these pups understood how to eat the whole fish immediately.
They were rock stars. Like, it was day one, Admiral got it right away. Like, understood completely, like, oh, yep, I know what to do. No worries, guys. You don't have to tube feed me anymore. I think Cobalt got it relatively right away. It was like by her second time, she had eaten her entire fish.
The pups have to be able to catch fish and compete for fish before staff will consider releasing them. And part of the reason harbor seals are generally able to be released after rehabilitation is kind of surprising. It's because, according to Costner, harbor seals are bad moms.
Like, I love harbor seals. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm a seal girl through and through. Harbor seal moms, awful moms. So they don't teach their young how to fish at all.
But in this case, for harbor seals, it's a good thing, because that means staff don't have to interact with them as much for them to learn the skills they need to be released, Costner says.
Because there's not a lot of maternal investment, we don't have to spend a lot of time with them. And so that makes them amazing rehabilitation and release candidates.
Other species, like sea otters under the age of 6 months, will never be released, says Emily Pomeroy, who works with Costner.
So when we do have patients that, you know, they come in, as Savannah mentioned, so critical and needing all of this extra help, and you see them recover and be able to thrive, to be able to, you know, release them into the ocean and see them swim away and just know that there's this amazing life ahead of them, and they're going to do all the things that they were meant to do as a seal. Like, that's so amazing, and it doesn't always happen. So when it does, it's extremely exciting and rewarding.
At this point, Cobalt and Admiral are almost completely hands-off, only being handled to get their weights once a week. They've learned how to fish, and they're now strong enough to be released.
The full scope of fish school is by the time that they go back into the ocean, they have to show that they can catch and eat a live fish, so they will get live fish. These kiddos have already graduated. They've gotten their graduation caps from fish school, and we do have a photo of, like, them, and we can show you in the kitchen.
The tassel's worth the hassle?
Yeah, the tassel's worth the hassle. Oh,
this is making me so happy. It's like the best story ever. Sorry.
Reporting in Seward, I'm Hope McKenney.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts, including on Spotify now. We had reports tonight from Reagan Miller and Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Claire Strempel in Juneau, Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, Laurelyn Cruz in Unalaska, and Hope McKenney in Seward. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 45 years. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.